I'll get my phone turned off. I heard it beeping over there a while ago. I can remember how. All right. Everybody remember what book we're in? Exodus. Book of Exodus. We've just finished 2 or 3 weeks before the shutdown, the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, first 17 verses or so, and then we had finished the chapter, and now we're beginning Exodus chapter 21. You'll see an outline laying around there. I encourage you to grab it, and there's only a few blanks on there this time. Before we begin, I want to make a few kind of preface the text with a few comments. And one is this, that we talked about how we're fixing to start into what they call case law. And I like to think of that, in case this happens, what do we do? Or in case that somebody does this, how do I respond? It's those kinds of things that there are, we might call them civil law in our government system today. But there's a number of them in the book of Exodus, some in the other Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy as well. As we go through these the next few weeks, occasionally, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Occasionally, we're going to look at a text. You're going to see something in there that bothers you. And the text doesn't even talk about it. In fact, the text seems like it's condoning it. It's saying it's okay. And it's easy for me to get my mind off of what the text does say and focus on, why doesn't the text deal with this? Why isn't God talking about this in this situation? And that's going to happen. And when it does, I want you to be able just to set that aside, set that big burning issue that you feel like ought to be dealt with, set it to the side and look at what the text does say. We'll get to the others perhaps between now and eternity sometime. Another thing I want you to notice is the room or the range that seems to be given for certain crimes, for certain sins. And we have that in our own society. Someone goes before the judge and they're found guilty and they're sentenced. And someone always says, what did he get? And there is a range there. The law may say this crime is punishable by up to 10 years in prison. So there's a range there. And you'll see that implied in a lot of our texts as we go through these things as well. Perhaps one of the most important things I want you to notice is who the law is given to protect. You see, the sermon of the message, or the title of the message this morning is this: God's concern for slaves and for life. The law is given not to give you a hard road to hoe. God gave the law not to make your life miserable, but God gave the law to protect other people from you. God gave the law to protect other people from me. God gave the law to protect me from other people. God gave the law to protect those who could easily be abused and misused. Notice that in the law. Another thing is that God permits. That is, God does not perfectly correct certain things in life. When someone commits a crime, God has the ability to perfectly correct that situation. But he doesn't. One of the most, I don't want to say troubling, but verses in the New Testament is where Jesus, and this is in the New Testament, this is not the law, it's in the New Testament where Jesus It's talking about divorce. And he said, God permitted such things because of the hardness of your heart. God doesn't perfectly correct the world in which we live by the law. And the next statement is the one that, if you get nothing else from the sermon, I want you to get this. It's the one that's got the blanks. God's moral laws are not intended to create a morally perfect society, but to bring sustainable order to an imperfect world. God's moral laws are not intended to make this world in which we live perfect, morally perfect. God's laws are intended and used to just make a sustainable order within it. Because you might keep someone from committing a crime, but that doesn't change their evil heart. It doesn't change their sinful nature. Now keep those things in mind as we go through our text. We're going to be looking at the first 32 verses of chapter 21. I can. God's moral laws are not intended to create a morally perfect society, but to bring sustainable order to an imperfect world. Need it again? Stephen's a slow one. He got it. If Stephen's got it, everybody's got it, right? Right, Charisse?
Yeah.
Verse 32 verses deal with nine situations in case law, so we've got to move. First one is laws regarding slavery, and you can, at some point if you want to, you can look up Deuteronomy 15, 12 to 14, which talks about the same subject, but elaborates on one point of it a little bit more that I'll talk about in a minute, even though we won't go to that verse. So let's read verses 1 through 11, chapter 21, Exodus. Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, right there it is. Right there our minds go to, why on earth are they even permitted to buy a servant? Why is there slavery? Why didn't God just abolish slavery from the get-go? So we get all turned off on a different path on this issue of slavery. I want to suggest to you this, that the picture, I know this to be true in my case, the picture that I have in my mind of slavery is perhaps, in fact, I'm 99% sure, it is inaccurate for what God has laid out for slavery within His own Hebrew people. When I think of slavery, I think of the slaves being one race, and that's black. I think of the master as being one race, and that's white. And it's a southern white man with a white straw hat with a big plantation in the background, and he's going around in his fancy duds and his wife with her umbrella skirt and all these things. And the slave said, yes, sir, master. And every once in a while, he gets a whip across his back. And every once in a while, the master has his way with the female slaves and all this type of stuff. I doubt if that's a very accurate picture of what slavery was like. I doubt it. You'll see things in this text that indicate it was not. Slavery. Why would someone buy a Hebrew slave? If you buy a Hebrew slave. The condition is there. If you buy a Hebrew slave. Doesn't say, don't do it. He says, if you do it. Why would they ever be a Hebrew for sale that you could buy as a slave? Remember, we've talked about the conditions of servitude. One was if someone had committed a crime, a theft, and they could not pay the fine. They could be put into servitude. Another one was if someone got into debt, could not pay their debts, they could go into servitude. Now, you think we don't have that today? I would bet that half the people in this room, the Bible calls you servants. Now, I'm not talking about servants of the Most High God. I'm talking about servants to a lender. If you owe money, the Bible says the borrower is servant to the lender. He may not live on a big plantation, but in some way, you are not free. Just miss a few payments and you'll find out. We have this thing called garnishing of wages. You know what that is? When someone gets behind on their payments, when someone gets behind and will not pay their bills or cannot pay their bills or whatever, they can have their wages garnished. That means that the law requires their employer to not give them their whole paycheck, but to send part of it to who they owe money to. You call that freedom? I don't. And here's what typically happens. The person who is having his wages garnished, he will hop from one job to another. You know why? They start garnishing his wages at this job, and he don't like his wages, people taking money out of his check, sending it to who he owes money to, so he'll quit that job and go work somewhere else. And it takes a month or two for the powers that be to find out where he's at, to find out where he's working now, and to catch up to him and start that garnishing process over again. He puts up with it for a little while, he quits that job, and he hops somewhere else. Is that what you call freedom? No. So just because we don't call him a slave, he feels it. In this day, there may have been people who were either they stole something and couldn't pay it back, or they were in debt. And so the solution for that was that they were taken into servitude and to someone, to the person they owed money to, until they could pay the debt off. Now let's suppose that Don Tibbett worked for the Dodge place up there by his house. He was the owner. And I bought a truck from him. He financed it to me, and I start paying him back. And I can't make the payments. I wreck the truck. I don't have any insurance on it. And he's out a truck. No, I'm out a truck. I owe him, let's say, $10,000. What options does he have in, we're going to go back to this day, to the Israelites' day. I become his servant, and I work it off until my debt is paid. Well, how am I going to do that to Don? Don may not want that. He may not want to see me. He may not want me around. One thing that Don could do is sell my debt to him. I owe him $10,000. He says, man, to someone, he says, if you will give me $5,000, you get it out of him every how you want to. So Don sells for $5,000. Now this new guy is got $10,000 coming. And he may work me off. He may work it out to me. We have that today, don't we? Collection agencies. Hospitals or whoever will sell their debt to a collection agency, and a collection agency will collect it as well as they can. Okay, call it different things. It's the same idea. So here is someone, a Hebrew person, who is in debt, either for his is just being in debt or for the settlement of a crime. And someone buys them. Okay, that's where we're at. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years. And in the seventh year, he shall go out free and pay nothing. Now, there's something different. We don't have that in our day. Not necessarily. Bankruptcy laws, interesting enough, are for 7 years or in some instances. But here, something that the person who is owed money to or the collection agent has to consider is, hey, I've only got 6 years to get this. So if it's a $12,000 debt, I've got to average $2,000 a year to get it back, because at the end of 6 years, it's over. Now, you can go to Deuteronomy and read that verse over there, Deuteronomy 15, and you'll see God's concern for the slave. Here you see it. 6 years is all you've got. There God is showing his concern for the person, that the mercy that he shows, that person gets a new start in life. In Deuteronomy 15, read that text, and he adds this to it. He shall go out from you at the end of that 6 years, owing nothing, but do not let him go out empty-handed. Because he has worked for you, he has made you a living, he has made you money. Make sure you give him something to help him start out. God's concern for that slave. Let's keep reading. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. But if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free. Then his master shall bring him to the judges. He also shall bring him to the door, to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Let's stop there. So here we give some regulation. If the servant comes in, if you buy this servant and he's already married, then when his 6 years is up, his wife goes out with him, retains the marriage. If he comes in by himself and you allow him to marry another slave that you have or whoever, and they have children, at the end of the 7 years, guess what? She stays. That doesn't sound good, does it? That doesn't sound right. But here's a couple things to consider. More than likely, this is no surprise to this man. More than likely, when he gets married in servitude, he knows the conditions. They know. And more than likely, at the end of those 6 years, he already knows what his options are. And he already knows what he's going to choose. He's going to reach. The option is there that he can stay married and have his own family within the bounds of that home. So he can do that. Let's go on. If a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. So here's a different situation. If a man sells his daughter, again, that sounds horrid. Why on earth would you sell your daughter? I don't have a clue. Okay, debt would be one. That would be there. But there are things that can come up where that's the best option. We're fixing to see an option. It probably goes on with verse 8. If she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceptively with her. Now, those last phrases there, that last phrase, gives us a hint that there's been some kind of expectations that this female slave has had. There's some kind of expectation that she's been given that he has reneged on. And it sounds like that he has promised her that she will be his wife. So she goes into this situation with the expectations that she's going to be this man's wife. And 4, he says, if the case be that he changes his mind. He does not want her to be his wife. Then he lets her go out, lets her be redeemed by her relatives or someone else within the Hebrew nation, lets her be redeemed, and she doesn't have to pay back the price that he paid to get her. Because he didn't keep his word. Verse 9 gives a second situation. If he has betrothed her to his son, then he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. In other words, if this slave is going to be his son's wife, then he is to treat her just as if she were his daughter. Same rights, same expectations. So there's the second situation. Third one in verse 10. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. So he takes this woman to be his wife. If he takes another wife, and there's another one of those things we throw, why on earth would there be polygamy going on here? I don't have a clue about that either. I can't imagine that. But he says, if he does, takes another wife, then he is not to treat her lower in any respect than he does this other wife. Notice verse 11. If he does not do these three things, either marries her like he said he would, either gives her to his son and doesn't treat her like a daughter, being her his daughter-in-law, or if he gets another wife and kind of casts her to the side. If he doesn't do any of those, all of those three things, whatever the situation is, if he doesn't do it and do it right, then she is able to go out without paying money. Now, where's this money going? From him to her or her to him? It's implied that it's not going from her to him. He has bought her, let's say $10,000 or whatever. And he, 6 months later, he decides, I don't want this woman. She does not have to give the money back because it's not her that has not kept their end of the deal. It's him. So, there are some laws regarding slavery. Number two, 12 to 14, talking about intentional homicide and acts of God. Let's read these verses. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. So here is a situation where if someone stabs somebody, hits somebody, shoots somebody, whatever, and they do it with premeditation, they do it intentionally, they lie in wait, the text says, so that they may kill this person. That is a capital crime. We might call that first-degree murder. I'm not sure what other terms you would use, intentional homicide. Premeditated murder, it's a capital crime, he says. But he gives a situation where someone may kill someone, but it not be premeditated. It may be self-defense. It may be an accident. It's interesting that he uses this phrase, God delivered him into his hand. When I read that, it makes me think that God's a party to this. Maybe God is intentionally doing this. And to a proper degree, he is. But the point here is that it is not premeditated. Guy either is having to defend himself or something, but it's laid at the hands of God. And here in this case, he says, I'll appoint a place where he may flee. Why does he have to flee? because this person's relatives are going to be angry. Somebody kills your brother, you want to know why. There ought to be a good reason for it. This may be the Hatfield and McCoys here or something of that nature. But God established places that people could go, safe places called cities of refuge, that people could go and be safe until their name was cleared or until things kind of settled down or whatever the case may be. These are not modern day sanctuary cities, obviously. But it's a place where someone could go for a safe haven until it was determined if they were guilty of premeditated murder or if it was self-defense or an accident. Notice he also says at the very last line there, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. I'm not sure what all that means, but over the years, and I think probably in every culture you can imagine, there have been people who are running from the law, are running from a vengeful person, and they think they can take refuge in a church or in a religious place. They think that no one will bother them if they're at the altar. God says, drag them from the altar. Take them out. There's no remedy. There's no mercy given for first-degree murder. It's a capital crime. Number three, dishonoring of parents. Verses 15 and 17, we're going to skip 16. It seems to be, I'm not sure there's a connection between these two, but let's look at 15 and 17. 15 says, "And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." 17, "He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." That sounds kind of harsh, doesn't it? If you hit your parents, if you strike your parents, it's a capital crime. If you curse your parents, it's a capital crime. You can see in Deuteronomy chapter 21 that this is not just an isolated thing. It's not just a first-time thing. It's a pattern of someone's life. Now, I'll tell you what it tells me. It tells me that dishonoring and disrespecting your parents is a far more serious affair than perhaps we think. I'm not suggesting that we should have capital punishment for these things in our society. Maybe we should, I don't know, but I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying it is a serious thing to disrespect and dishonor your father, your mother in such a way that you strike them, that you hit them, that you beat them, that you kill them, even that you curse them. I know what some of you are thinking, because I'm thinking it myself. Years ago, I think it was Leslie Harmon gave me a book to read about raising someone who is not your child. A bond between, it wasn't just that, a bond between a child and the parent. A natural bond. The book starts off, I didn't read the whole book, but it starts out with this story of a little girl, 3 or 4 years old, who was rushed to an emergency room or a burn unit because someone had poured gasoline on her and set her on fire. When she was able to communicate, Again, I'm not sure how long that period of time that was. She was wanting her mommy. Calling for mommy. Wanting her mother. The problem was, it was her mother that did it. You could tell me, I could tell you stories, horror stories of parents who have physically abused their kids. Parents who have committed capital crime against their children, even though their children may not be dead. I know that. I know that. But the point is, that he's making here is disrespecting your parents is a horrid thing. Child abuse, in my opinion, is a capital crime. As you read through the scriptures, note the instructions that are given for a child to honor his parents. Number four, laws regarding kidnapping. This is verse 16. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. If you're someone kidnaps someone and sells them as a slave, the kidnapper has committed a capital crime. If someone kidnaps someone and they are the person who has been kidnapped is found in their possession, they have committed a capital crime. The person being kidnapped does not have to lose their life. Number five, laws regarding assault. Let's read verses 18 and 19. If men contend with each other, in other words, they're fighting. Two people are fighting one another. This is not a one-sided thing. They're both going at it. And one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but is confined to his bed. If he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. Acquitted from what? Murder. Because the guy didn't die. He lived. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. So what's happened here? Two guys are fighting. It's assault. It may have started... One guy may have started it more than the other guy, but before it's all over, they're going at it. They're fighting. And one guy gets hit in such a way that he's unconscious or knocked out or he can't participate in the fight anymore or whatever, and so it's kind of over. But he's hurting. If he dies, there's a good chance that the other guy could be found guilty of murder. Now, let me give you a situation. I've heard this all my life. I've wondered all my life, what would I do if somebody breaks in my house and starts to do this or starts to do that? Or you know, whatever wherever I find myself, if somebody attacks me, assaults me, what can I do? You always hear the advice, you know, that somebody gives you. If they're outside, drag them back in the house, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know. What's going on? What should we do? Let's say I'm arguing with this guy and he gets vicious. He gets angry and he pulls a knife. And he's, as far as I know, he may tell me, I'm fixing to kill you. And so I pick up a baseball bat. And he's coming at me with a knife, and I hit him, and I kill him. Have I murdered him? No. That's self-defense. Suppose we're going at it, and I hit him a good lick across his ribs and break his ribs. And he's laying on the ground, and he's through. He's through fighting. and nobody's around. At that point, he's not a danger to me anymore, is he? At that point, I can't be charged for murder. He's not a threat to me. He might be next week, but he's not right now. If I take my baseball bat and bust his skull in and kill him, what then? Murder. I have committed first-degree murder. Why is that? Wasn't it self-defense? No. Not at that point. He was not a threat to me anymore. Now, I'm not sure what I would do. I'd probably been already been the one with the broke ribs or a knife in me or something anyway. But who knows what you would do? But there's the fine line there that the law recognizes. So just because someone starts out being the aggressor doesn't mean you cannot commit a crime in the course of it. Number six, laws regarding beating of servants. This is another one that we ain't gonna like. We don't like these servant things. If a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Now I read that, and it doesn't say how he's punished. And when I read that, I kind of come into my mind, you know, you go, don't do that. And you treat the matter real lightly. I don't think that's it at all. I think if the idea is that if he beats his servant and kills him, then he's charged with first degree murder. He will not go unpunished. It's murder in that case just like it is in any other case. Look at verse 21. It kind of gets worse. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. That doesn't set well. So you're on the clock. You know, I've beat him within an inch of his life, and if he makes it for a couple of days, then I'm off the hook. That's not what he's saying. It's not what he's saying. What he's saying is there is a limit, a time limit, upon which the guy can be charged for murder. If you beat someone and they don't die, you can't be charged for murder. If 6 months later they die from something else, you didn't kill them. They died from something else. It wasn't the murder there. Now there are some assumptions that need to be talked about, or at least need to be acknowledged here in these verses right here. If you see them on the outline there, on the back page there. It's still a capital crime if you kill a servant. Premeditated. There's a limit as to how long the owner can be charged with murder. Number three, correction, not death, was intended. He uses a rod, not a sword. Next one, useful labor is a right of the owner. If someone has bought a slave, he has a right to expect the slave to work. He has a right to expect money for his investment. That's a right. He has that expectation. Nothing wrong with that. If he has that expectation, then the next one is also a given. Coerced obedience is a right of the owner. In some way, he has a right to compel this person to work. Now, it doesn't mean he has a right to beat them, but it means he has a right to force them in some way to work. Punishment is required, but not specified. Perhaps the servant is partly to blame. That's why there are room for judgments in here, because you don't know if the guy just got mad at him or if the slave refused to work. There are a lot of things that have to be taken into account. If it is minor and the servant quickly recovers, no punishment is given. The owner is going to suffer loss regardless. He's still paying his food bill. He's laid up forever, how long he's laid up, injured, and he's not getting any work for sure then out of the guy. So there are a lot of things that come into play in this situation. Number seven, laws regarding harming a pregnant woman. We talked about this in the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. And let's read these texts. We won't spend a whole lot of time there, but let's read them. If men fight and hurt a woman with child, hurt a pregnant woman, so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows. In other words, the baby is okay, she is okay. He shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him. He shall pay as the judges determine. You see a range there of judgment. All right? But you do see a judgment. Someone hurts a pregnant woman, it may be unintentional. It sounds like here there was no intent to harm this pregnant woman. She gives birth prematurely, but everything ends up being okay. He's still fine. He's fine in a way that is satisfactory to all parties concerned. But verse 23, but if any harm follows, then you should give life for life. If unintentionally someone hurts a pregnant woman doing something reckless like fighting, and they kill this child, it's a capital crime. If they kill the mother, it's a capital crime. You will give life for life, verse 24, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. A judgment call as to the amount of harm that is done. Number eight, laws regarding harming of servants. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, then he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let them go free for the sake of his tooth. Now here you can, this gives you a little more insight as to the setting of some of these previous verses. Because these things seem very lenient compared to the others at first glance. If you're hit your male servant and knock his eye out permanently, he's free. He's free. It's not an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It is worth more for the servant. His freedom is worth more than for the owner to have his own eye knocked out or whatever the case may be. He knocks out a tooth, the servant is free. He is set free for the sake of his tooth, it says. Then we get to number nine, laws regarding livestock violence against other people. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. So let's see what that says. The guy has an ox, and it gores someone and kills them. The ox, what happens to the ox? The ox is killed. Its flesh cannot be eaten. Not going to eat the ox at that point. Why not? Is it something about killing the ox or what the ox has done that makes his meat unfit to eat? I don't think so. I think that what it is a showing a respect for life, for human life. You will not profit not even one T-bone steak from this ox because it has taken the life of a human being. Verse 29, but if the ox tended to thrust with its horns in time past, and it has been known to its owner, and he has not kept it confined, so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also be put to death. A capital crime. If you've got a vicious animal, and it has in time past showed itself to be vicious, and you did not get rid of it, you did not kill it, but you kept it, and it does it again, you are guilty of murder. You have committed a capital crime. Now, I don't have an ox, so I ain't got to worry about that, right? No. I may have something else that's just as capable. Okay? Forget the ox. Let's go on. We'll come back to this. Pharaoh imposed upon him a sum of money. He shall pay to redeem his life, whatever is imposed upon him. You can see in the book of Numbers, I think it may have that verse here, Numbers 35, that tells us that someone who has been convicted of a capital crime and is sentenced to death, you cannot, there is no possibility they can redeem their life for cash, for money. It says they are not eligible for another sentence. They will be put to death. But here is the one exception. If I have an ox and he has been prone to gore in the past and I didn't take care of that and he kills somebody, I've committed a capital crime, I've been sentenced to death, it is possible in that situation, with the approval perhaps of the victim's family or whatever, or the judge for sure, that I can redeem my life for a suitable fine. Let's go on. Verse 31, whether he has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment, it shall be done to him. So he's not saying there's a difference in value between a son or a daughter. It's just saying it doesn't matter if it's a kid or an adult. It doesn't matter if it's his own children or whatever the case may be. If the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. This is not saying that this scenario here would be a first offense. If in the first offense this ox kills someone's servant, the ox is killed, and the man has to pay not for the servant's life. It's not saying the servant's life is valued at 30 shekels of silver. It's the lost work and labor that the owner has entailed. If this is a second offense, where he knows he should have kept the ox put up or whatever the case is, he doesn't do it, it's a capital crime. He's committed a capital crime and his estate has to pay the other owner for the price of the servant's labor. Everybody following that? Now, we don't have ox. All right? The most likely scenario you'll see in this situation is with dogs. I'll tell you a story. I think I may have shared this in another setting years ago. But where we live, when my boys were 3 to 5 or 6 years old, their grandpa, Susan's dad, gave them a hound dog pup. And that wouldn't have been my first choice of a pup, was a hound dog, but he gave it to us, so we have this pup. Well, 2 or 3 days later, someone dumps off another pup at our house. It looks as a Heinz 57 of some sort, just a dog. So now we got two dogs. And we got someone visit. Kathy Webb is here this morning. Her dad used to live right across the street from us at this time, and her sister lived right down the road. Her sister had a dog. Kathy, you may remember this. It was part Doberman Pinscher and part Pit Bull. It was grown. My dogs were pups. By the time my dogs were about 6 months old, they started running around with this dog. And this dog would not come in our yard. You know how pit bulls tend to be kind of standoffish, or at least some of them do, and just look vicious. I don't know any other word to describe it. That's the way this dog looked. My dog's pups, they were about 6 months old, started running around with him. Well, one day I came out of my house, and I was working in my shop, and just as I came out of the house, my neighbor drove up. He's got some cows. He's in a flatbed Dooley farm truck, and he drives up, and I walked out of my shop, and he gets out, and he says, my dogs are laying right here, and he says, how long have your dogs been here? I said, I don't have a clue. I just came outside. I don't know. He said, well, my dad, who was an old man at the time, saw three dogs running out of his field. One of them had an orange tag on its collar, which one of our dogs did. He said, they killed a newborn calf. And he said, I don't know if it's your dogs, but it might be.
And instantly I knew what I thought had happened. My dogs had been running with this other dog. And they had killed this calf. And I told him, I said, I bet you anything this is what has happened. And he said, if I see him in the field, I'm going to kill him. And I said, I don't blame you a bit. And I said, I'll go down and try to look at this other dog or get Kathy's dad to Dale and see if he can corral this dog and just look and see if it got blood on him or whatever. And he showed me the calf. It was on the back of his truck. And it was eat up pretty good. And so he did, and the other dog had dried blood on its face and stuff. Well, that night, it was on a Wednesday night. We went to church. On our way back from church, this rancher and his dad and his brother and sons were standing outside one of them's house that we had to go right past there, just stand out there talking. During the day, I had done a little calling and stuff and found out what the value of a newborn calf ought to be. And I stopped by there, saw them out. I had intended on calling him. I stopped by there and I told him, I said, I want to pay you for the calf. He said, no. He said, I don't know that your dogs did it. But he said, if I see them out in the field, I'm going to shoot them. And I told him, I said, you won't have to, because I'm fixing to do it myself. And we gave Susan's dad her pup back. He would have never understood the reasoning behind that. So we gave him the dog back. It's 20 miles away, so that'll be okay. I killed the other pup, and Dale asked me to kill Karen's dog. And so I killed him. Why is that? Let me tell you what this text tells us. I've got it written here. The ox is killed because the potential loss of more human life is worth more than the life of an ox. I'm not saying the life of a human is worth more than the life of an ox. It is. I'm saying the potential loss of a human life is worth more than the life of that ox. That ox is as dumb as an ox. He does what maybe comes natural. But when he threatens human life, he's forfeited his own. My neighbor, the thing that my neighbor had a right to was this. He drove a truck for Stevenson Oil, a fuel truck that delivered oil to farmers and ranchers or wherever. That's what he did for a living. My neighbor has a right, when he got up the next morning, not to have to get up an hour early and go set watch in his pasture. He ought to be free from doing that. And if I had kept a vicious dog or a dog who would participate in such a thing, my neighbor would not have been free. He would have had to worry about that every day, where my dogs are. I have a right, I have a responsibility to see that my neighbor does not have to be in that situation. He needs to be able to get up in the morning and know those dogs are not going to bother my cows because those dogs are dead. Everybody following me? That may be tough. We don't like to kill animals, especially our own. But there are times when that's the right thing to do. We're through with verse 32. We'll take this up next week. Let's pray.